AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, Brett Johnson with you here on a Tuesday afternoon. And today we are joined by the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer. That's Patrick Coolican, who joins us every Tuesday. And you can find more about what they report on over at the Minnesota Reformer, minnesotareformer.com, as they do a great job on following all the big political stories around the area today. Patrick, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. So got a number of quick hitter stories to go with. And I guess the first one I'd like to start with, well, kind of two stories combined into one. And it has to do with following up on bills that were either passed or vetoed during past sessions of the state legislature, because it's important to pay attention to these things. And let's start off talking about what's happening with Uber and Lyft drivers and how much money they make. Because you might remember that last year, Governor Tim Walz vetoed a bill that would have set minimum pay rates for Uber and Lyft drivers. And he said he was going to commission a study that would take a look more about how Uber and Lyft drivers are paid around Minnesota. Well, that study is out. And a first-of-a-kind analysis shows of more than 18 million trips taken on Uber and Lyft in Minneapolis in 2022 shows that most drivers in the Twin Cities Metro earned $53 an hour on average for the time they spent transporting riders, but drivers earned slightly less than the $15 an hour minimum wage in Minneapolis and St. Paul when accounting for the entire time drivers spend on the apps and deducting about 60 cents per mile in expenses under the federal mileage reimbursement rate. So, in other words, they're making less than they probably should, according to these statistics. So I'm curious, Patrick, do you think this report could have any sort of impact when it comes to either the state passing more regulations on pay for Uber and Lyft drivers, or even at the local level in Minneapolis, where I know the city council has been taking action on this already?
Yes, I thought it was interesting last week. The timing of the city council's move to pass the ordinance came a day before this big report came out, and we learned and reported early Thursday that the city council was actually aware that the big report was coming out on Friday, and they opted not to delay their vote, which to me I found very curious. You would think you'd want all that data before you made a decision on rates, but they went ahead anyway. It leads me to believe that they're not going to budge at the city council because they were kind of set on what they thought the race schedule should be, and I don't think that they're necessarily going to be persuaded by all this new data. The city council's rates are higher than what would be needed to achieve a minimum wage. The only question is, will some of this data, which shows how much drivers make, will this persuade one city council member, which would mean that if they could do that, then they'd have trouble. If Uber, Lyft, and their allies can do that, they would have trouble overriding Mayor Fry's veto. So the other issue here is that we're now at the legislature. Senator Omar Fateh has released his bill, and they've introduced the rates as of today. They're very similar to what he offered up last year, which I think is probably a non-starter for Governor Walz, who's already vetoed the bill last year. But Governor Walz is certainly in a tough spot here because this is an important part of his own political coalition. And last year, the bill did pass both the House and the Senate. I'm not sure if he wants to go through the drama of a veto again. So we'll have to see how the negotiations go from here, and also whether or not Minneapolis lawmakers at the legislature are willing to preempt the city council's move here. I think that would certainly ruffle some feathers as well. So it's going to be an interesting few weeks here on the Uber Lyft front.
Yeah, especially if they do go that preemption route, since oftentimes it has been Republican state legislatures doing that to Democratic-controlled Democratic-controlled cities, and this could be the case of a Democratic-controlled legislature preempting a Democratic-controlled city, which would certainly add a new angle. But you can read more about what Max wrote about this report showing how much Uber and Lyft drivers make over at MinnesotaReformer.com, MinnesotaReformer.com. I want to talk about another bill that passed the state legislature last year that did get signed into law, and this has to do with those PFAS chemicals, because Dina Winter over at the Reformer has been writing about the impact of PFAS or forever chemicals for a couple of years now. PFAS, if you're not familiar, are used in numerous products because they're highly resistant to heat, oil, stains, grease, and water. And as the name implies, they last forever and can cause some real pollution and environmental impacts. And this is especially true in the East Metro, where the water supply was contaminated. There was a young woman by the name of Amara Strand who was sick with a rare form of cancer. She was one of many cancer patients at Tartan High School in Oakdale, which was the area where these forever chemicals were found. She led an effort to ban the chemicals, which led to a law that was passed back last year. It takes effect in 2032, banning of these PFAS chemicals, unless the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency deems their use to be currently unavoidable, which is defined as essential for health, safety, or the functioning of society, or for which alternatives are not reasonably available. So in other words, a bunch of companies are going to be able to apply for exemptions to this PFAS ban. And as you might imagine, a number of big companies like Honeywell, Honda, and Polaris are lining up for these exemptions. So I think it's important, because the devil's always in the detail with these bills, even when they get passed, that exemptions are going to be lined up. And Honeywell especially has taken on a very aggressive stance with them trying to get what they are called HFO or F-gas is an exemption from this PFAS chemical bill, correct? They've gone undertaken quite the lobbying effort.
Yeah, I mean, I think what the with this issue shows is that there's always going to be policy trade-offs, and Honeywell is trying to exploit that tension. And what I mean is that they've invented products that they say have been excellent in reducing greenhouse gases. The problem is that they are in the PFAS family. What they're trying to tell the state is, well, look, if you want to meet your aggressive climate goals, you really have to be accepting of our coolant products that use these very useful but also dangerous chemicals. And so that's kind of the tension that the state bureaucrats are really going to have to work through. As it is, as you said, it's one thing to say, well, we're banning these products, and then you say, but not if they're important to health, safety, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that's kind of a giant loophole, and we're seeing companies trying to drive through that loophole. Honeywell's has been particularly aggressive, as you pointed out. Dina got through a public records request, got some of the records of Honeywell's lobbying. They sought to have a call with the governor. They sought to set up this kind of these public policy roundtables with state, federal industry and other groups. And apparently the Senate President, Bobby Joe Champion, and Kerry Dietzick at that time was the majority leader. They were supportive of this idea. And then by August of last year, the MPC, Pollution Control Agency, which is of course involved in writing the rules that are sort of the flesh and bone of these, of the skeletal law. They said, well, this is kind of uncomfortable here. What are we doing? Why are we getting so close to Honeywell on this? And so they, the state stepped back from that whole, Honeywell driven, policy roundtable idea. But I think we're going to see, this is just the beginning. We're going to see a lot of this. And you know, of course, 3M is the big player. They're the ones who have invented and manufactured a lot of PFAS. So just the beginning on this, and I think, like we've talked about in the past, there is a big engineering challenge, because these products, which are highly resistant to heat and water and a bunch of other stuff, it just means that's why they're in so many products, because it's a very useful chemistry. And so we're going to have to figure out a way around that. And including some of these products are, as Honeywell is trying to argue here, they're important for other environmental goals that we have.
And really here in Minnesota, we don't have kind of a baseline to work off of because, as I believe, we are the first state to ever ban these PFAS chemicals. So it's not like we can really go to another state and look at a model for what they did. So what we do here could have an impact on other states if they decide to ban these PFAS chemicals as well. So there could be some significant decisions coming out of the NPCA in terms of, well, who they decide to exempt on these things.
Yeah, I mean, this is the only problem with being first. When you jump off this cliff, you don't really know what's on the other side.
Absolutely. Well, hey, let's stick with some news over at the state legislature. And these are, let's talk about some bills that, well, haven't become bills yet. And starting off talking about prone holds and school resource officers, this is something that the state legislature is looking to modify after last year's debate over this. And right now, Michelle Griffith is reporting that there is a bill that would allow school police to use prone holds, meaning face down, that passed the Senate. But there is a potential hiccup, as you write. GOP senators successfully amended the bill to allow other school workers to use prone holds to prevent theft, damage, or destruction of property. So I'm curious now where this is at right now. Were DFLers able to pull this amendment out, or could this end up staying in the final bill? Because that does seem to be a pretty broad definition of allowing other school workers to use prone holds to prevent theft, damage, or destruction of property. I could see that being a pretty wide definition to allow those prone holds to be continued to be used.
Yeah, you wind up with somebody could steal from the cafeteria and suddenly you're using prone holds. This did go to a conference committee. It was a very quick conference committee this morning, and they stripped out that provision. So now it'll go back to the House and Senate, where they'll vote on it, and presumably it'll pass both chambers, and the DFL will be done with this issue that I'm pretty certain they find very uncomfortable, and will be happy to have dispensed with 8 months before the election, which is really what this issue has always been about in my mind.
Yeah, an issue that can't go away soon enough for them in their minds. That is certainly for sure. I want to talk about another issue over at the state legislature. This really isn't any specific bill per se, but it has to do with more procedures in the state Senate. Because Republican state senators during a Senate Rules and Administration Committee hearing proposed restrictions on the circumstances in which senators can vote remotely. And this is significant because DFL Senator Carrie Dejic, former majority leader who stepped down from her leadership position but is still serving in the state Senate, is undergoing treatment for a recurrence of cancer. And as you might imagine, she oftentimes would take advantage of remote voting. And the DFL just happens to have a one-seat majority. So I'm curious, what justifications are GOPers using to justify this other than just straight-up politics? Because as I understand it, there have been another number of Republican senators who have taken advantage of remote voting over the past few sessions. And now all of a sudden they want to ban it because there's a DFLer who's going to be using it more frequently. And the DFL happens to have a one-seat majority.
Yeah, it's hard to view this as a good faith pursuit of good government or anything like that. One seat majority means that if one DFL senator isn't there, everything grinds to a halt. And so I think that's probably what's going on here, and I think it really backfires because you've got somebody here who's undergoing cancer treatment. She's already. Last year, she had serious cancer surgery, and she's obviously a tough fighter. And attacking somebody who's a cancer patient, I think most Minnesotans would take a dim view of that behavior. And it's kind of in keeping with Steve Drazkowski's history as kind of a provocateur. In general, in politics, you probably don't want to go attacking the cancer patients. That's my amateur pundit view of it anyway.
I think just about any political consultant would probably tell you, yeah, that's a good idea. And finally, to close things off, I want to talk about a column that you wrote that has to do with those primary results we saw in Minnesota last week. And you write, warning to the DFL, Tuesday was a bad night for President Joe Biden. And you write how here in the state of Minnesota, the uncommitted vote got 19% of the vote, which was higher than what was picked up in Michigan, which received a lot of national press attention. In fact, the uncommitted vote in Minnesota captured a majority of two state House districts in the Minneapolis area and also won a plurality of votes in a third House district. In 15 additional districts, the campaign notched at least one quarter of the DFL vote. So, talk about why you think the DFL should be concerned by this. Would this be a lot of voters who would be coming home to Democrats and Joe Biden in the fall? Or is this something that could be a larger concern for DFLers where even if, let's say, 5 or 10% of these people who vote uncommitted decide to stay home, well, that could have a big impact in the fall. So what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, to start with, I'll just say that, you know, the news cycles move quickly now, and I think people were encouraged by the president's kind of vigorous speech on Thursday night. There's been a lot of concern about, among voters, they say in polls, about his age, and I think it was smart of them to put him out there much more frequently, doing a lot more media, and he is, and it seems to be going pretty decently. But that said, you know, I think I've been telling people I do get those 2016 vibes where, there was the assumption that the Bernie Sanders wing of the party, and he won the caucus here handily, I think by 2-1 margin over Hillary Clinton. It was just there's kind of an assumption that those voters would come home and also that, that Clinton would carry Obama voters, neither of those played out quite like Clinton supporters would have hoped. And Donald Trump came within 44,000 votes. A lot of the difference was in other parties that racked up a fair number of votes, and so I just think that's something to be on the lookout for. Will the base be engaged? And then at the same time, can you hold those suburban moderates, former Republicans, or maybe their parents were Republicans and now the next generation are kind of soft Democrats? It's a somewhat fragile coalition, and so I think that Democrats better be motivated and a little anxious going into the fall, especially with that narrow House majority. Because remember, in 2016, even though Trump didn't win, Republicans carried both chambers. They won the majority in both chambers, really thanks to those Trump coattails. So to me, it was a little bit of a portentous night. But we'll see. I mean, I think a lot of this is just going to depend on how much energy President Biden brings to this campaign, and how much resources they put here, because they certainly put a lot in 2020. The Clinton campaign was not much to speak of here in 16.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if the Trump campaign puts a bunch of resources in Minnesota like they did back in 2020, when you knew Trump was certainly thinking he wanted to be that first Republican to win Minnesota since 1972. But yeah, how those uncommitteds end up voting in the fall will be the big question, because if it is a repeat of 2016, as you said, that could spell disaster down ballot, because thankfully Minnesota did not have a governor election in 2016, or we very easily could have had a Republican governor as well. We are just about out of time, but you can read more about Patrick's column on that on the results last night from Super Tuesday over at MinnesotaReformer.com, titled "Warning to the DFL: Tuesday was a bad night for President Joe Biden." Again, read all of those stories we talked about today over at MinnesotaReformer.com. All of those news and stories and columns, MinnesotaReformer.com. We have been speaking with Patrick Houlihan, who is the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer. Patrick, as always, thanks for coming on the show today.
Always a pleasure.
All right, let's take a break and send things back over to Matt McNeil on AM 950.